WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Monday, April 17th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Here are the stories we're following today. It turns out Alvin Bragg's lawsuit against Jim Jordan isn't proving very intimidating. As congressional Republicans continue to go after one of George Soros' most zealous DAs. On Thursday, Republican Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona introduced two pieces of legislation targeting the Manhattan DA, whose main campaign promise was that he'd go after Donald Trump. Biggs introduced the Accountability for Lawless Violence in Our Neighborhoods Act, or the Alvin Act. The Alvin Act would prohibit Bragg's office from receiving federal money, and it would require his office to pay back any federal funding he received after January 1, 2022. Biggs' second proposed bill, the No Federal Funds for Political Prosecutions Act, would prohibit state or local law enforcement agencies from using funds or property seized through asset forfeiture to investigate or prosecute the president, vice president, or a candidate for the office of president in a criminal case. Here's Biggs discussing these latest developments.
This is basically to make the point that he has no authority to be going after the president for politically motivated prosecutions.
Well, it's interesting, as we know, Congressman, I mean, he campaigned and said, my top priority is to get President Trump. What do you think, by the way, is going to come out this week? Because on Monday, Jim Jordan's hearings are going to start. And basically, Bragg's record, if you will, or lack thereof on fighting crime is going to be on the hot seat. How important do you think that moment's going to be?
Well, I think it's important. I'll be there as part of that committee. And I can tell you, Rita, that when you start looking at the data, you will see that Mr. Bragg claims that he's got the safest big city in America. But let's take a look at the rising crime rates. We're going to have victims there talking about their stories. When you have a prosecutor who basically tries to bust down every case he can that's charged originally as a felony, wants to break them down to be misdemeanors. He wants to release people from jail. He doesn't want people to have to pay cash bail. He wants everybody out on the street, no matter how dangerous they are. And it makes the place unsafe. And that's what I think we're going to see in our hearing on Monday.
And speaking of corrupt ways to burn through taxpayer money, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Seymour Hersh recently reported that the Ukrainian government has pilfered millions of American taxpayer dollars. Hersh posted on his Substack that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and his entourage has embezzled $400 million by skimming U.S. dollars intended for buying diesel fuel. Hersh broke the story earlier this year that the United States executed a covert sea operation that took out Nord Stream Pipeline 2. Last week, Hersh reported that, quote, the Pentagon was paying as much as $400 per gallon to transport gasoline from a port in Pakistan via truck or parachute into Afghanistan during the decades-long American war there, end quote. He also reported that Zelensky has been buying fuel from Russia, the country with which his and our nation are at war. In his Substack report, Hersh provided a little insight of how our government deals with this type of corruption. Quote, the issue of corruption was directly raised with Zelensky in a meeting last January in Kiev with CIA Director William Burns. His message to the Ukrainian president, I was told by an intelligence official with direct knowledge of the meeting, was out of a 1950s mob movie. The senior generals and government officials in Kiev were angry at what they saw as Zelensky's greed because he was taking a larger share of the skim money than was going to the generals, end quote. Apparently, following that meeting, Zelensky's remedy was to dismiss the 10 most ostentatious generals, the ones bragging too loudly and driving Mercedes. The establishment opinion cartel has worked hard to convince Americans that Zelensky is a champion of freedom, deserving of Western support in his heroic fight to fend off the Russian bear. But the New American Magazine's May 16, 2022 cover story titled A War Between Two Villains provided a far more accurate assessment. We reported that the people of Ukraine are paying a terrible toll in a war not of their choosing. But just as with the Russian people, there's a huge chasm between them and their rulers. If Seymour Hersh's latest story about Ukraine's fuel money embezzlement scandal is accurate, it would align with the pattern of deep corruption on the part of the Zelensky regime going back to before the current war began. And last Thursday, federal authorities arrested a 21-year-old member of the Massachusetts National Guard for releasing classified documents online. According to the leaked documents, Ukrainian forces are in worse shape than acknowledged. The U.S. spies on its allies and its adversaries, and the U.S. has 14 special forces on the ground in Ukraine. The latter leak is particularly significant because it means the Biden administration has directly deployed the U.S. military in Ukraine without the knowledge of the American people and without the constitutionally required declaration of war by Congress. This deployment, though small, could quickly escalate and suck the United States into the war in a much bigger way, particularly if any of the U.S. special forces are killed. It's also illegal since it violates the Constitution. But the major media and political class are so busy attacking the 21-year-old guardsman for leaking the documents that they're overlooking the illegality and significance of the Biden administration's secret actions. One exception is Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who tweeted in defense of the guardsman. She tweeted, "Jake Teixeira is white, male, Christian, and anti-war. That makes him an enemy to the Biden regime. And he told the truth about troops being on the ground in Ukraine and a lot more. Ask yourself, who is the real enemy? A young, low-level National Guardsman or the administration that is waging war in Ukraine, a non-NATO nation against nuclear Russia without war powers?" Joining me to discuss today's stories is the New American's executive senior editor, Steve Bonta. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Paul. How are you today?
Good. That's kind of a good question, right? Who is the real enemy? Because I'd imagine there are some, and I think there may be good causes sometimes for some sort of secrecy, right? Classified and things like that. What are your thoughts in this scenario?
Well, there's so many different ways we could go with this. I mean, one of my reactions is that what's going on in Ukraine right now is very much akin to what we've seen in every other foreign war that America has been involved in, including the world wars, you know, including the Great World War, you know, World War II, you know, the Moro Crusade against the fascists and the Nazis and so forth. Regarding the troops, the special forces, it has been claimed that they're being used to guard the embassy in Kiev. So I don't know how that figured, if that's true or not.
Yeah.
I guess we'll see. But it is fairly standard for the U.S. to deploy where we are permitted to do so, which is not everywhere, but to deploy limited military troops to guard embassies and similar.
Yeah, 14 doesn't sound like a lot.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's pretty clear that the British special forces that were also part of the revelations in these leaks seem to be the British government has an official policy. They don't make any comments about the deployment of special forces. But it seems pretty clear that some of them are in more forward positions, perhaps, doing battlefield training or actually providing logistics and support on the front lines. It's not entirely clear. Yeah. As for the rest, it's long been said that war is a racket. It's the ultimate racket. It's the racket that enriches certain interest groups, international banks, obviously defense contractors and people like that, everyone related to the, war is a tremendous opportunity for profit-taking for certain people. Obviously, corrupt politicians benefit from it in so many different ways. And I think the Biden administration, the Biden crime family, as it's been called, is perhaps uniquely corrupt, with the possible exception of the Clintons rising to that level.
Uniquely corrupt, huh?
Yeah, well, it's clear.
So
I don't think it's on today's news menu, but they're continuing. Well, I think it is later
it
on.
It is, we'll talk about it later.
Revelations about their connections to communist China as well, another avowed enemy of the United States. So, but the same could be said, a generation ago of the Clintons, during the Clintons' time in office, and certainly, Barack Obama. And the Bush family, and so forth. This is not a partisan issue, folks.
Yeah.
So just so we know.
Isn't it interesting based on Hirsch's description there of how the CIA interacted with Zelensky, it seems like this was not surprising. It's not surprising that they're skimming off, that there's and we've, there have been rumblings that this is happening. Everyone knows, I guess. It sounds like everyone knows that this is happening. But so should we still be outraged? I mean, these are millions, not billions of dollars. Well, millions, according to this racket, from taxpayers. And here we are, you know, people are living paycheck to paycheck. That may seem like a strange way to put it in context, but it's happening. Is it beyond any hope?
Well, I think that when the United States embarked primarily under the Wilson administration 100 years ago on this cause to democratize the world, at least yeah. that was the surface pretext.
That's gone real well.
Yeah, I mean, after the end of the Cold War, there was a brief period when that strategy seemed to be vindicated in some people's eyes. You know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it was assumed it would be only a matter of time until the Muslim world and obviously the communist China and North Korea would follow suit. And of course, after a couple of decades of a more or less unipolar world dominated by the U.S., all of a sudden, wow, we have boomeranged back into something, frankly, a lot worse than the Cold War.
Well, even in our country, right? I think that's the scary thing.
Sure.
Is that it looks like we've become more like these totalitarian states than they have become of what the old U.S., at least for that brief period of time, was.
Well, and I mean the degree to which we, led by insiders and subversives in our government during the Cold War, were being enticed to emulate the Soviet Union is nothing by comparison with the degree to which we are now trying to emulate communist China, because the insiders perceive communist China as a communist socialist success story. You know, look how rich they've gotten. And yet they have their people completely under control, their society completely stabilized, their elites are completely entrenched in power. There are no vexatious mobs or anybody else, any contrarians out there like us, you know, questioning their authority. There's none of that in China. And they would dearly love to implement something like that here. So it's no surprise, and we'll discuss this also a little bit further on today's program, the degree to which Western elites are looking at China now as their model and saying, wow, China is showing that this really can be done. We really can have global form of totalitarian socialism and make it work.
There's been a recent influx of commentary from people like Donald Trump, Ron Paul, and Steve Bannon's shows on Tim Pool, and lots of people going around openly and more brazenly and with more fervor saying that they've used the word coup, that there isn't a coup within our government. So this is finally coming out. I guess us being the John Birch Society here is like, well, what in the world took so long? What in the world took so long? We've been talking about this coup for a while, right? How piece by piece, element by element, institution by institution, there are conspiratorial forces taking over our institutions and thereby piece by piece our nation. And finally, now that it's out in the open, everyone's coming out and saying it. Isn't that frustrating?
Well, I mean, I think there was a major inflection point with COVID.
Yeah.
And then following that, the naked attempt to take down and destroy not just President Trump, but all of his followers.
Yeah.
Particularly those of any consequence. It's ongoing, of course, even as we speak. And it's so blatant that only the most purblind partisans can fail to see what is happening.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Thanks, Steve. Stay tuned, folks. After this quick break, we're going to discuss the latest revelations on the Biden family's corrupt dealings and the newest globalist attempt to install universal, trackable money.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board. And I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
Welcome back. Let's look at our other stories. The revelations about the Biden family's corrupt dealings with communist China continue to trickle out. According to GOP Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Chinese-American bank Cathay Bank has given up incriminating records of millions of dollars of transactions from Chinese companies to Hunter Biden. Here he is discussing the matter with Fox News on Sunday.
I thought what was interesting is that Cathay Bank, I know they're denying any involvement with China, just like TikTok, but I thought it was rather revealing that they just handed over records to our Senate committees without any compulsory process. I think it'll require a subpoena process, a compulsory process on the part of the House to get the bank records and not only understand the inflow from different countries into the Biden family coffers, but then where, the outflow. Where did it go once it went into
right.
a bank controlled by Hunter Biden? Did it go down to the Cayman Islands somewhere, the Bahamas? Or, how did the big guy maybe get his 10%? That's what needs to be investigated. By the way, we handed all this over to U.S. Attorney Weiss. He's been sitting on our records now for months, probably evidence for years. Where's the U.S. Attorney's investigation into this as well? He's got stronger investigatory powers than certainly Congress does at this point in time.
Can you answer this question really, really fast? I do have to go. Why do you think that Cathay Bank gave the records so readily?
I think it's a shot across the bow.
Joe Biden?
Showing the Bidens, this is what we can do. This is the information we have.
Let's remember that all major Chinese companies are Communist Party affiliates. There are no independent, purely capitalistic big money ventures in China. So any payments from any Chinese company larger than the neighborhood takeout are payments approved by the Communist Party for ends serving the CCP's interest. This is why Senator Ron Johnson said that these latest revelations are the Chinese government telling Joe Biden, "We got the goods on you, buddy, and we're willing to dish it up." And the International Monetary Fund has jumped on the central bank digital currency bandwagon. On April 10th, the Digital Currency Monetary Authority, or DCMA, announced the launch of an international central bank digital currency, the Universal Monetary Unit, or UMU. The Digital Currency Monetary Authority was founded in 2013 with the mission of developing a digital currency that would use the same technology as Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, but which would be compliant with all central banking monetary standards. This means that, among other things, the Universal Monetary Unit will be fully trackable and will be recognized by governments and their central banks as legal tender, especially for international settlements. The DCMA became the standard bearer for the creation of an international digital currency in 2018 when one of its leaders, Daryl Hubbard, was invited by the Chinese government to consult in Beijing with officials from the People's Bank of China, which is China's central bank. Since that time, the DCMA has been coordinating its development of an international digital currency with Communist China's effort to create a digital yuan. The DCMA's goal is to achieve what Hubbard calls Crypto 2.0, which is a global digital currency system for central and commercial banks. If this is successful, it will become the first truly global currency and will fulfill a core ambition of globalists like economist John Maynard Keynes, who advocated for a global currency but was never able to achieve it. So, Steve, what do you think of what are your thoughts on these money matters here?
Yeah, well, again, and I think we've talked about this in principle before, these things are so vitally important. And
so boring?
So boring. You anticipated my next words. At least not for people like me. I mean, I'm a boring person by nature, and so I just gravitate toward this stuff.
I fell asleep almost saying that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's in my DNA. So let me see if I can just clarify this for our listeners a little
bit. Help us out, yes.
Well, let's start with John Maynard Keynes. So John Maynard Keynes was a very prominent economist back in the mid-20th century. And at the end of World War II, well, near the end of World War II in 1944, at the behest of Keynes, a conference was convened in New Hampshire at a place called Bretton Woods.
Okay? Yes.
And this conference was to plan the post-war global financial architecture. And to give a little more background, prior to the war in the 1930s, most of the world had gone off the gold and silver standard in reaction to debts from World War I and then the volatility of the Great Depression. And that created all this international instability as different countries practiced currency policies to try to disadvantage each other and so forth and so on. So there was a perceived need, since the decision had been made to abandon gold and silver, to create a new monetary order that would confer, you know, stability and prosperity. So part of this, part of Keynes' program, was to set up a single global central bank that would issue a single global fiat currency. And by fiat currency, we mean a currency printed, like the dollar, okay? Except that it would be international, okay? It wouldn't be beholden to any national government.
Yeah.
In fact, he even had a name for it. He wanted to call it the Banque Or, which comes from the French words for bank and gold.
But they weren't able to do that, so they used the dollar as the reserve, right?
Right. So the so politically, that wouldn't quite fly. Wouldn't fly. I mean, the countries weren't quite ready to abandon their financial sovereign, their monetary sovereignty.
Yes.
So they adopted, he and Harry Dexter White, the two leaders of the conference, sort of adopted a fallback position. And the fallback position was that instead of creating a global central bank, they would create two much inferior, in their eyes, international kind of intermediate international authorities that would sort of be placeholders until a global central bank could be put in place. They were the IMF, or the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. So the International Monetary Fund is in charge of currency issues. The World Bank is in charge of loans, particularly to poor countries. Enough said on that.
Yeah.
The other pillar was currency. What are you going to do about that? Well, they agreed to transform the U.S. dollar into the world's reserve currency unit.
Right.
And initially,
which
it was
taking a hit now. As that.
Well, yeah. Well, initially, under the Bretton Woods Agreement, the dollar was backed by gold for any foreign holders of dollars or dollar-denominated debt. So that meant that if some guy in France, or the French government for that matter, bought U.S. Treasury debt, okay, it could, in theory, redeem them in gold anytime it wanted. So this is the only conditions under which other countries would accept a sort of dollar situation. Then when President Nixon was president, because of debts that were run up during the Vietnam War, decided, well, we need to go off of this remaining gold standard. And he basically told the rest of the world, guess what? We're repudiating Bretton Woods. The dollar is going to be a fiat currency from now on. Deal with it. And so that created the great economic shock of the 1970s. And more or less since then, the international markets have learned to cope with this. But we've never had any serious move towards a global—I mean, people have talked about it, theoretically. But the mechanism for creating a true global currency that would replace the dollar ultimately has not really existed until the invention of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin. And suddenly, a bunch of people started saying, maybe at long last, here we have a mechanism, a technology that will allow us to create a global currency. So that's what's going on. Now, the DCMA, which has a website, this is the Digital Currency Monetary Authority, is somewhat mysterious in origin. I've tried to figure out exactly where it came from and precisely what its relationship to the IMF is. It seems to be some kind of affiliate at this point, but it is a little bit odd. And as you mentioned in the introduction, there's the really significant fact that in 2018, one of the founders of that organization was invited by the Chinese communists to go to Beijing to confer with them, China being the one major government that is making significant progress toward creating fully digitized currency, which they can then track. Okay, so a digital currency means that every single time you spend it, there's a record left that the government can follow.
Does it necessarily mean that? Because a lot of the crypto people, whatever, pushing them, there's an aspect of this conversation, this narrative, that says that this is non-trackable, that this is Bitcoin, for instance, I believe, is supposed to be non-trackable, like decentralized money.
Yes, well, the point is that that Bitcoin was explicitly designed not to be a legal currency, okay? So this is the first type of currency ever that will comply with all of the regulations set in place by the central bank network that by which they declare something to be legal tender, and so that includes trackability.
Yeah. So this is just another move. We've reported over the last few weeks of nations moving away from the U.S. dollar, and this has been happening. Is this basically? Are we watching in real time the move from from fiat now to digital? So we move from real money to fiat to digital. Is that what's happening?
Well, digital is really going to be a type of fiat currency. Okay, so it will, and in fact, I just want to say that the structure of this new thing called is called the Unicoin or Universal Monetary Unit, UMU. Yeah. Anyway, it will be structured exactly like the dollar and every other fiat currency in that its supply will be controlled by what are called open market operations.
Yeah.
They will offer a discount window. There will be reserve requirements. The only difference is that this will be ultimately a currency and an issuing authority, a central bank for central banks in the long term. We don't have time to go into further detail, but we'll probably talk about this more because this is a really, really important development.
We're going to talk about it Friday because isn't that what our, I think that's what our Friday
it might be.
Episode is.
That would be a good topic.
Thanks, Steve. That's all for our news segment today, folks. For more truth behind the news, make sure to get a subscription to the New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com or by calling our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. That's 800-727-8783. And stay tuned, because after this, we're going to show an interview with New American Senior Editor William Jasper, who discusses his latest print story, Biden's ESG Agenda. And we'll look at the latest great installment of Gary and Steve's Principal Series. We'll be right back.
As a lumberjack, my job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Visit thenewamerican.com for real news you can trust.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that. Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more, including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
Next up, the New American's editor-in-chief, Gary Benoit, interviews senior editor William F. Jasper about his cover story article, Biden's ESG Agenda, in the magazine's April 24th print edition. Let's watch.
And today we have with us William F. Jasper, senior editor of the New American magazine. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Gary. Always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Now, Bill, you wrote the cover story for the April 24th issue of the New American Magazine entitled Biden's ESG Agenda. What is that all about? What is ESG and why should we be concerned?
Well, it is hitting all the headlines now, Gary. We see it just in the last few days with the furor over Bud Light bringing Dylan Mulvaney, the transgender guy, and to pose as a woman and sell their Bud Light. It's caused quite a furor. But Nike has done the same thing, brought the same Dylan Mulvaney, and he's famous for being a tranny. Mm-hmm. And so we see Nike doing this as well, basically saying, we don't care what our customers are thinking. This is the cool, woke thing to do. So we're going to begin promoting this. And that is on the advertising agenda of many of these big corporations. But it is impacting Americans in a whole host of ways that they're just beginning to see. In their employment, in their ability to speak publicly, to post things on the internet. If one runs afoul of the ESG agenda, that is, if one is not sufficiently woke, or that's the term we've been using, it's much more sinister than that. If one runs afoul of the ESG agenda, we could find very soon that you get deplatformed, you get fired from your job, you lose your monetization on your website, your internet, you get kicked out of your school. A lot of things are happening. We're finding all across the country. One of the things that's particularly concerning to many people is that many of these big corporations that are employing the ESG agenda are putting it to work with regard to pension funds. And that has could jeopardize people's income during their golden years. So there's many things like this that we can dive into here during our
conversation. Now, you're talking about not just impositions coming from big government, but you're also talking about impositions coming from big corporations. And really, you're talking about a partnership between the two, where big government interests and big corporate interests are working together to impose an agenda that most Americans would oppose, and to use their money, to use the money of taxpayers, and also to use the money of pensioners, people who have invested, and even customers.
Yeah, so here's the real sinister dark side of this, which I come to at the end of my articles on this, is that we are really seeing a convergence here where our system, the free market system that has built America into the prosperous powerhouse that it has been for the past century and a half, is now being converged with, conflated with communist China. So if you look at the ESG, environmental social governance, each one of those three prongs claims to represent an area of our social life in which we must express some kind of virtue for some social good. This is really an adaptation of the social credit system of communist China. Now, a lot of people would think, well, that's kind of bizarre. These are big companies. Why would they be adopting a communist socialist system? Well, you have big companies, big corporations, some of the biggest in the world, in China as well. And in fact, many of our big companies have built those Chinese companies. So we have big Wall Street asset management firms like BlackRock and Blackstone and Carlyle Group and State Street and Vanguard that have been in the forefront of investing in China and building this communist, fascist, cartel, monopoly system there. And they're doing it here as well. And one of the big platforms for pushing this, where we see the communist regime of China and all of these big corporations from around the world coming together, is at the World Economic Forum. And we go into my articles in the history of this and how the ESG was promoted into the corporate world by the World Economic Forum and the World Business Council for Sustainable Development and the United Nations. And that is the matrix that has brought all of this together.
And I think the matrix is a good way of describing it, Bill. If people are familiar with the movie The Matrix, we're really talking about control of the people. And obviously, a lot of people may be confused in terms of thinking about big capitalist and big communists working together, pinstripes and reds. But it makes perfect sense if one recognizes that communism and socialism is not about sharing the wealth, it's about controlling the wealth. And there are people who have benefited from the American free enterprise system who want to control the wealth as well. They want to eliminate the competition. And the best way of doing that is through government and through a partnership between government and big business. So how does ESG fit into all that?
Well, it is the tool. It is a sledgehammer that is being used to break down both the psychological barriers of Americans to create fear that if you do not comport all of your activities and your speech and your company profiles, for instance, this is really an attack on companies as well. Mm-hmm. All of the lesser companies are being told, if you don't conform to this ESG rating system, if you don't strive to get good points on your company rating system, you as a company will be canceled as well. Not only will you not get contracts from the government, but you won't get contracts from the big corporations that do have contracts with the government. And so we see this marriage between government and capital, government and corporate America and the global corporate structure, but also So that is putting pressure from the top, from government and from the big corporations on everybody to conform. But they also have pressure from below. That is the flash mobs, the LGBTQ, LMNOP flash mobs that are out there lecturing us, hectoring us every day, telling us that if we don't accept men in women's clothes as not only acceptable but virtuous, that we are being hateful, that we are being oppressive and exclusive. We need to be kind and inclusive. We need to welcome all of these people, transgender activists who dress up in women's lingerie and come to our libraries to cuddle children. We're supposed to accept that. If we don't, then we're a terrible person. We're hateful. And of course, everyone knows that this is a lie. Everyone knows that this is a big con that is being promoted. But they have the levers of power. They have the media. All of the media is on board with this, Hollywood, entertainment. And so no one wants to be exposed to the hatred and vitriol of the mob. And they can, many of the companies that have tried to stand up to this, find out that the LMNOP flash mobs will swarm their internet website, give them all kinds of bad reviews, accuse them of being hateful companies. And so we see a lot of the corporate structure caving in on this.
Well, I agree with everything you said, Bill, but nonetheless, it's hard for me to imagine the average guy, let's say, watching a football game, and he's in his home, he's on his sofa, he has a can of beer in his hand, and he takes a drink from that can of beer. Does he really want to see somebody on that can identifying as somebody of the opposite sex?
Well, already we're seeing, you know, that's really an important point. Already we're seeing there is a backlash to this, as would be expected. Will it be sufficient, and will people get to the shoulder shrug stage, you know, which was part of the strategy outlined by Kirk and Marshall, two of the big homosexual activists, psychologists, 3 decades ago. They said, look, if we just saturate the media enough with this, people will get tired of it, and they'll just get to the shoulder shrug stage and say, okay, well, you know, that's all right.
I'm glad you bring that up, because I recall it vividly. We both were on the staff of the New American and on the staff of the John Birch Society 30 years ago, and I remember you writing about that 30 years ago and projecting the lines. And we both recognized the direction that things were going. We both recognized that we would reach the point where we are today, but nonetheless, and we've talked about this, I'm incredulous that this revolution, this subversion, has occurred as fast as it has.
Well, yes. I mean, it is still astounding. One has to just shake one's head and go, you know, how is this possible? This is demonic. It's delusional that this could, so many people could fall victim to this. And that particularly with the transgender movement that we've seen just in the past couple of years, where even liberal lefties like Bill Maher have been astounded and said, this is crazy. And in another couple of years, the whole all of our young people are going to be trannies. So, and this is particularly pernicious in that this is now involving a terrible child abuse in which we are mutilating bodies, cutting off body parts, and injecting kids, little kids, with hormone treatments that completely violate all biological and personal and ethical norms, and that are irreversible.
And of course, what you're talking about, Bill, is what's done to the physical body. But how about the spiritual side of things?
Well, yes. So, right. We are we are composites of body, mind, and spirit, soul. We have a soul in our bodies. And once those things are very delicately combined, and when you start messing with the biology, you affect the psychology and you affect the spirit. And so many of these people are now unable to reverse this, and we have many people trying to detransition from this, but you can never get back to the way you were created. So this is against science. It is a denial of science. It's a denial of the most basic biological, anatomical sciences that we have. And it is an endangerment, not only of those individuals, but of all society. And the ESG program is meant to give a layer of respectability and an overlay of virtue on top of this insanity. And if it isn't resisted, then we will go down. We are going down very rapidly right now.
And right. And of course, all by design, because the people on the top who are responsible for this agenda and opposing it on the American people, their purpose is to destroy our Christian-style civilization, to leave smoldering ruins on which they want to build their New World Order. Bill, we've spent a lot of time on the transgender movement or the transgender lobby, which is hugely important, but as important as it is, there are other aspects, other elements to the ESG agenda. Could you list some of the others?
Well, yes. The biggest one, of course, we've been dealing with for over 30 years is global warming or climate change. And along with that, we have decarbonization, getting rid of fossil fuels, the zero carbon push, all these other environmental claims that form the E in the ESG, but also gun control. Right now, in this past week, again hooked together with the transgender, is the Nashville shooting and the other shootings that have taken place. So the global wokists are pushing for disarming America at the same time that they're pushing for decarbonization and ruining our energy structure. Those are some of the real big items that are being pushed. And a lot of this, I go back in the history in our articles, came out of the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, which we covered for The New American. And it was the World Economic Forum and the World Council, Business Council for Sustainable Development, that began promoting that in the big business circles. The United Nations Association, the United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, we go into the history of that, how they formed the basis for impact investing. That's what it originated as. Impact, how you could use investing to change the social structure using various corporations and the big financial institutions to invest and to then push and nudge and drag corporations into carrying out the revolution. A very important part of that was the Rockefeller Foundation. We go into that. Their big retreat that they had at their Bellagio Center in Italy, which brought together a lot of the corporate globalists, the one worlders who are pushing for a United Nations world government, a new world order, clear back decades ago. And the Rockefeller Foundation, of course, is one of the main tax-exempt foundations that have been promoting these regimes for a long time. So people need to realize that what we are seeing right now, when it bursts full-blown onto the world scene, has been incubating for a long time, and various pieces were being put into place, and various players were being established in various organizations and companies so that all of this could come together at the appropriate time. And now is the time. And so,
and it's becoming more and more obvious. Bill, we're out of time. Could you, in a few seconds, give a recommendation as to what viewers can do about this massive assault on our liberties and morality that you're talking about?
Yes. Well, first of all, go to thenewamerican.com and read the articles that we've done on this. And in there, we go into the encouraging things that are happening, where states, governors, state attorney generals, and state legislatures are banning various ESG proposals and agenda items, and bringing lawsuits against various of the companies or the Biden administration that's trying to shove this down our throats. So there are very real and concrete things that we can do.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Bill. And of course, for our viewers, we encourage everybody to go to the April 24th issue of the New American Magazine to see your article, Biden's ESG Agenda.
As a lumberjack, my job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Visit thenewamerican.com for real news you can trust.
And now, to complete today's program, we go to the New American's Gary Benoit and Steve Bonta for another installment in their series on basic principles.
This is Gary Benoit, editor-in-chief of the New American Magazine, and today we have with us executive senior editor Steve Bonta for another installment of Principles.
Hello,
Steve,
hello.
Thank you for being here.
Good to be here.
Now, what principle would you like to talk about today?
Well, the last time we talked about unalienable rights. Mm-hmm. So I think now it probably behooves us to talk about a few of those rights specifically. The idea that unalienable rights are rights that come from God. And one of the rights that people love to talk about in today's world is freedom of choice. It seems that pretty much all of the major political issues are framed in terms of freedom of choice. The question becomes, is freedom of choice an unalienable right from God? And our answer would have to be yes, with some qualifications, because, you know, we sometimes say we have something called free agency or absolute freedom of choice in this life, but I prefer the phrase moral agency. So agency is the power to act in and of ourselves, mm-hmm. and that's undeniably a capacity that God has given us, and it distinguishes us from other organic forms of life that can't really, I mean, maybe can make choices, but not in any long-term purposeful way. We as human beings alone have the ability to plan, to think in terms of, you know, the future, which even the most intelligent of animals generally can't do. They're limited to thinking about the here and now, if they think at all, right? But we can think about the future, we can think about alternatives, and we make choices and plan accordingly. So this is all what's bound up in with agency. And it's essential to our progress and growth as individuals. But if we live in an environment where choices are made for us by government or some other coercive agency, you know, we're being reduced to the state of animals. The cow or the ox does not have a choice as to whether to shoulder the yoke and do the bidding of his master when the time comes to work. Okay, the dog doesn't have a choice if his master decides he needs to be spayed so he can't have offspring, and this kind of thing. So animals don't, and we don't see anything wrong with that because we understand that in some sense, animals don't have that same cognitive skill, that ability to plan and make choices and to set goals and try to achieve them and in all ways do things that contribute to our personal growth. So that's what agency is. It comes from the Latin word agere, which means to act. Mm-hmm. So human beings, we might say, alone have this capacity to act purposely. And so the freedom to make our own choices about what course of action to take is absolutely essential. And it is God-given and unalienable.
Sure.
But that said, there are very reasonable limits. Now, the first kind of obvious limit is that we don't have a legitimate moral choice to do things that cause harm to others. So if we
right.
look at the abortion movement, I mean, that whole freedom of choice mantra that's employed by those who, in point of fact, favor
unlimited abortion is based on the idea that the so-called fetus, okay, is not really a human being, and therefore it's not deserving of the same level of protection as the mother. Only the mother, you know, has a legitimate right to life in that situation. So the paramount thing that they see is the mother's freedom to choose. Okay, but we understand differently. We talked in an earlier episode that the right to life is fundamental and probably even more fundamental than the right to choose in any sense. We all have the right to life. And that even applies to helpless unborn babies who maybe have not yet developed the facility to plan, to act, to think, to do all the things that fully formed mm-hmm. human beings can do. But nonetheless, by virtue of being human beings, they enjoy that right to life. And that supersedes the so-called freedom of choice to abort a pregnancy. So that's one instance where a right can't be, you know, completely appreciated if we think of it in terms of an absolute thing. You know, no matter what, I have the choice. Okay.
Well, I have heard it said that freedom is the freedom to be able to swing your arm so long as it doesn't hit somebody else's nose. I'm sure you've heard that before. And certainly abortion fits into that category because the mother would not have the freedom to swing her arm to the point where she's killing the unborn child. But let's take another example, though, because I don't think that expression about being able to swing your arm so long as it doesn't hit somebody else's nose, I don't think that's 100% correct. And I'd like to point to the example of suicide. What if somebody were to decide, I'm going to kill myself? And that certainly is against the law. Is that a violation of freedom?
Yeah, I mean, as a practical matter, if a person decides to take their own life, it is very difficult to stop them from doing
right.
that if they're resolved to do that. Because, you know, unlike a person who is bent on doing harm to someone else, where the other person has the option of defending or running away or whatever, suicide is kind of a different thing. But we believe, again, going back to the right to life, which I think really has bearing on this.
Yes.
The right to life is paramount, which means what? It means that life is given by God and can only licitly be taken away by God.
And I think that
unless
is,
we're talking about
right.
accidents.
And I think that's the key because what would the philosophical argument against suicide be? And I think that argument would be that our life is not our own. Now, it's certainly not the government's. It's certainly not somebody else's. But it's God's because God is the creator. God created each and every one of us. So God gave us this very precious gift of life. And in fact, you would have to say the most precious gift, would you not? Because if you didn't exist, you couldn't therefore be a beneficiary of all the other gifts from God.
Well,
so God
I
gave us this gift, and do we have a right to destroy it?
Well, in the here and now, certainly the gift of life is. There are other gifts like the gift of salvation.
Oh, absolutely.
That supersede even that.
But again, if we didn't exist, how could we have salvation if we didn't exist to begin with?
Right. So I mean, and the problem with this is, you know, you can go down rabbit holes. You can say, well, what about a person who is who commits suicide, but they're non compos mentis, or somebody who an agent who commits suicide to avoid being captured and tortured by the enemy, and it goes on and on. I mean, you can always look at exceptions. The problem is, and the nature of principles and the nature of natural or God's law is that there will always be circumstances where you can look at it and say, but what about? This is why we have juries and courts and a legal system, and we don't merely have a code of law that says, okay, if you do this, here's the consequence, and, you know, write down, this is the old, you know, imperial approach to law, the idea that you can frame these things in unexceptionless ways, okay? So, I mean, you know, for example, one of the Ten Commandments is thou shalt not kill, but the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, is replete with examples of God commanding people to kill under certain circumstances. So he does reserve the right maybe to change things. So,
right.
But as far as, you know, government and law and so forth, that doesn't invalidate the principle. Okay, I mean, just because, and this is a problem with the modern kind of nominalistic way of reason. It is to say that, you know, if you look at something and you know, some aspect of human behavior, let's say, which is very complex, and you say, well, you know, 99% of the time, this tends to be the case. But I can find 1% of the case where there's something else where you can argue for an exception. So therefore, sure. That invalidates everything else. And that's just not a wise way of thinking about it. So as a general principle, the right to freedom of choice in the sense of exercising that moral agency that I talked about is sacrosanct.
Well, and I think the key is the word moral coupled with the word agency.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, because without it, we're nothing more than chattels to the state. Okay, and obviously, large swaths of human history have featured people living under precisely those conditions, whether, you know, whether outright chattel slaves or subjects to an absolute despot like a pharaoh or a communist leader or something like that, where or for that matter, living in societies where you don't get to make any of the important choices in your life by social convention because of a caste system or something like that, you know, whom you marry, where you live, what occupation you have, those are all choices made by other people, you know, your parents, an astrologer, or whatever. And so in that context, too, we see this sacred right of individual, I would say maybe self-determination, a freedom of choice being severely abrogated. And this, again, is something that throughout much of human history has been the rule rather than the exception. And so it's only been relatively recently, for example, that the concept of individuality has become dominant, that the idea of individual rights and with it the idea of life being fundamentally about individuals pursuing happiness and growth and progress. You know, that's a very, very novel idea. It's only been around for a few hundred years.
I would say even longer, would you not? Because really what you're talking about are just basic Judeo-Christian principles.
Well, yes, the principles, but in terms of being recognized generally in legal systems, you know, the Judeo-Christian world lagged many centuries behind in you know, fully, you know, instantiating those as part of their legal code, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, J.B. Bury, the famous English historian, wrote a book called... Anyway, it's a history of the idea of individuality. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, even in Greco-Roman times, with maybe the exception of Seneca and a couple of others, you don't see this idea of the individual being important, of individual growth and progress and choice being important. You really don't see that emerged as a fully splendored thing until the late Middle Ages in the Christian West. And even then, it took several centuries more. And even today, it's a constant fight against those who would collectivize us, against those who would take away that freedom of choice. Why? Because the collective is more important, they say. Okay, or society is more important, they say. Or security and stability are more important, whatever the pretext.
And really what's most important is each and every one of us is individuals because God created each and every one of us uniquely. Steve, thank you so much, and we look forward to the next episode next week.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. Have a good rest of the day, and we will see you tomorrow.